From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, journalist and author Alex Kotlowitz talks with us about his newest book on the impact of gun violence in Chicago, An American Summer. Then author and journalist Paul Hendrickson says, yes, architect Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't a very nice person, but his new book implores you to look further.
You scrape all that away. You cannot go away from looking at these buildings without appreciating there is a fundamental soulfulness at work.
And global information systems have brought a wealth of information to our fingertips. But there's still so much that's unknown.
The world does feel small now. We know what's happening in every corner of the globe, and all this information is at our fingertips. But in reality, the world is still very, very, very big and filled with more things than we can ever imagine.
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. When Alex Kotlowitz's book, There Are No Children Here, first came out in 1992, the country was facing unprecedented violence. Homicides in the nation's largest cities were at an all-time high, triggered by gangs and a drug trade that dominated many of the country's poorest neighborhoods. His book was set in the Henry Horner Homes, a public housing project on the west side of Chicago. But much has changed over the last decades. The Henry Horner Homes, as well as many other public housing projects in Chicago, were torn down. The gangs that once ruled these areas were similarly demolished, as gang leaders were jailed with hefty sentences. Violence decreased, but it didn't vanish. Kotlowitz's latest book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It tells 14 stories about loss, family, and survival in a city that continues to be racked by gun violence. Kotlowitz was in Milwaukee for an event at Boswell Book Company in March, which is when he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone.
I have to say, writing questions for this interview was really difficult. It's hard to find a place to begin, in part because I don't think anyone can read this book and not feel like these conversations are a little insufficient. Right? Insufficient in some way. But I'd like to start here. Why did you write this book? Why right now?
In some ways, this book is kind of a bookend to my first book, There Are No Children Here, which came out some 28 years ago. And one of the things that knocked me off balance when I was working on that book was the just pervasiveness of the violence in the community I was writing about. You know, I was following two young boys in a public housing complex. And I have been really distressed and sobered by the stubborn persistence of the violence. And my feeling over the years is that we've completely underestimated the impact of the violence on the spirit of both individuals and the spirit of community. And that's what I wanted to try to get at in this book and these very intimate stories.
You know, one of the things the book talks about is PTSD. And it's one of those things that you go, it's not quite the right word because it's never post.
Right. You know, there's a conversation among social workers who work in these communities, and I certainly saw it in the people that I spent time with. You know, they have a lot of the same symptoms that combat veterans had returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they're easy to anger, they have trouble concentrating, they're self-medicating by smoking marijuana or drinking, trouble sleeping, just anxious all the time. But as you suggest, while they have the same symptoms of those who've experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, there's nothing post about it because they experience the violence, they lose a loved one, they're a witness to an act of brutality, and yet there's no safety, there's no place of respite. They are still looking over their shoulder for what's going to happen next. And so social workers have this informal term in these communities, it's what they call complex loss, the idea that you may lose someone close to you, but then have to reckon with what lies ahead.
There's so many different coping mechanisms that are on display in this book, and I'd like to get back to that, but to kind of go back in Chicago's history, because we tend to talk about violence in Chicago as though it's still kind of the 1990s, as though it has these mechanisms that are in some ways no longer there. So how have things changed in Chicago since you wrote There Are No Children Here?
Sure. Well, the two most notable things that have changed is as bad as the violence is now, and it is really bad, it was actually worse some 28 years ago. Though I will say the numbers in the past couple of years have approached the numbers of the 1990s again, which has been really disturbing and unsettling. But the other part that's changed considerably is back in the early 90s, the gangs were organized around the drug trade. And so the violence was much more directed. It was usually over controlling their turf or their terrain. And in the late 1990s, the law enforcement agencies went after the heads of the snake. They went and arrested many of the gang leaders in the city. And as a result, the gangs began to fall apart. And now, you know, the police estimate there are now 600 to 800 different cliques or crews around the city, organized block by block. They're not organized around the drug trade. The violence feels more arbitrary. It feels more petty, that somebody's been disrespected in some manner. And it feels much more unpredictable.
You mentioned cliques, of course, and in the book you speak with someone who was the head of a gang in Chicago, and something that he talks about is exactly what you mentioned, how arbitrary the violence has become. When you're talking about these cliques, it seems as though everyone in the book is part of something, that it's kind of unavoidable.
Well, it's hard if you're young, especially a young man growing up in these communities, just by the nature of where you live, not to belong to one of these organizations. And I think one of the things that was clear to me, and you see it in some of the stories in the book, is that often when the newspapers or the police report on an act of violence, the first thing that they describe about the victim is the fact that they were a gang member, as if that somehow is what defines them. And as a result, people, loved ones, are, you know, their immediate stance in the wake of losing someone is to defend them, because there's this kind of notion out there, I think, that what goes around comes around.
One of the things the book really does is it does humanize people. You know, you read headlines, especially if you're in the city of Chicago or if you're in a city like Milwaukee, honestly. And it is very matter of fact. This person was shot. It was at this corner, and this is their criminal record. But there is so much more to that person. And the interesting part of it is, of your book, is that you not only humanize the victims, but you also humanize the perpetrators.
What I wanted to do in this book, I was looking for, you know, the book is, it takes place over the course of this one summer. It's a collection of 14 stories. Some of them course through the summer, some are self-contained. And I was looking for stories that upended my thinking, that challenged my own sort of presuppositions and assumptions. And what I wanted to write, I wanted, you know, the kind of centripetal force of storytelling is empathy, this idea of trying to imagine yourself as others. And I wanted to try to write this book without judging, but really trying to understand. So the stories really vary. And as you mentioned, one of the stories is about a gentleman who, at the age of 18, in an act of vengeance, one of his friends has been shot and paralyzed, goes out and kills a rival gang member, and he ends up serving 14 years in prison. And Eddie Bocanegra, his story is really a story about trying to forgive yourself for what you've done. And Eddie, as an adult, has devoted every minute of his life to trying to undo some of the damage that he help cause when he was younger. He's, you know, working in violence prevention. He's mentoring young people. I mean, just an extraordinary individual. But the story itself is Eddie's still trying to find a way to forgive himself for what he had done.
One of the stories that stuck out to me was the mother of a man who was shot by another man in a situation that it seemed like no one really came in with good mm-hmm. intentions.
Right.
And it really highlighted how people can end up really on either side of that
right.
equation.
Right. No, the lines are often blurred. I mean, the story you talk about is a story of this extraordinary woman, Lisa Daniels, a single mom. Her older son is an engineering student at University of Illinois, and her younger son, Darren, he wanders, he strays, he gets involved in dealing drugs. Lisa does everything she can to hold him close. And then one day he goes to buy some drugs, a small amount of marijuana. It appears that he had all intentions of robbing the drug dealer, and that the drug dealer may have had all intentions of robbing him, and a shootout erupts, and Darren is killed. And so two things happen. One is that the local newspaper runs a story about Darren's death, and all it talks about is his criminal record. He had spent some time in prison. And Lisa, his mother, she wasn't in denial. She knew exactly her son's history. She knew what her son had done, but she knew there was so much more to Darren. And so she made it a point to letting people know that her son was a much richer, complicated human being than the authorities would lead you to believe. And in fact, she got on her license plate, on the frame of her license plate, it reads, "I had a son, his name was Darren." But the other remarkable thing about Lisa is, you know, she assumes that the person who killed him is going to go to away prison for a long time. It seems like a kind of open and shut case. But as it turns out, the witness to the shooting had a criminal record and made for a suspect witness. And so the state's attorney decides that they want to offer a plea deal. And Lisa says, okay, but I have one request, and I want to give a victim impact statement at the sentencing. And usually victim impact statements are about the impact the death of the loved one has had on you and your family. And so Lisa gets up in the courtroom and she talks a little bit about that. But then she gives this remarkable talk where she asks for leniency, where she forgives the person who shot her son. And in fact, to this day, she's got a correspondence with the young man who's now serving time in prison.
Her story is so remarkable, I think in part because many of us, although we want to believe we would be like her, I think many of us know that maybe we couldn't.
It is really hard, and I think to be fair, and I really want to be careful about this, and Lisa knows this, is that there are instances where forgiveness is really, really hard, if not impossible, when there's no sense of remorse on the part of the individual who had done the shooting. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, no problem. But one of the things I was about to ask is there are a lot of different coping mechanisms, but also just responses to the violence that people mm-hmm. see, that they experience. What are some of the ways that people deal with this onslaught of violence?
You know, the thing for me that was notable among most of the people I spent time with is they hold on to their feelings and their experiences really tightly. Not only are they not encouraged from talking about it, but sometimes discouraged out of fear that if they do, they'll be held culpable for the crime. And so for many of the people I spent time with, it was the first time they spoke about their loss, about what they were going through. I mean, there's this kind of utter sense of loneliness. And that, you know, that grief, that trauma can take a toll on individuals. You know, people look for solace in all different manners and ways. You know, many of the mothers who grieve in Chicago, they form support groups amongst each other. After a shooting in the city, the shrines arise, you know, flowers and balloons, you know, and in the summer, they're kind of, you can find them virtually everywhere. So people have all these different ways of managing. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter is, I think by telling stories is what, there's a great line in Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, where he writes, you know, it's this novel about, loosely based on his experience in Vietnam, where he writes, you know, this much is true, stories can save us. And I think what O'Brien was saying is that if we can tell our stories, if we can share our stories, that's what ultimately will connect us, will make us feel less alone.
Well, and with that thought, you know, these stories are in some ways very uniquely Chicago. But you didn't title the book A Chicago Summer, you titled it An American Summer. And of course, these stories are very familiar here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the elements of these stories that are universal and really speak to the violence that we're seeing throughout the country?
Right. Well, I titled it that way for two reasons. One is that, you know, you're right. The book takes place in Chicago. It just as easily could have taken place in Milwaukee and in Detroit and Philadelphia, Baltimore. I mean, there's so many cities that are experiencing this. But moreover, you know, we're a city that has, a country that's been racked by gun violence. And what's notable to me is that in the wake of the tragic shootings in Newtown and then Parkland, we asked all the right questions. You know, well, what brought this young man to do what he did? How do these individuals in this community emerge with all that's bearing down on them? We don't ask those questions in places like Chicago or Milwaukee or Detroit or Baltimore. And we need to start asking those questions.
What do you hope people take away from this book? People who might not know anything about the city of Chicago, who may have a lot of misconceptions about what gun violence looks like.
Yeah. And again, I don't see this book as a book about Chicago. I feel like it's really a book about the kind of soul of our country. And what I want people to come to understand is that in some ways, the book is a kind of rallying cry that we need to begin really sort of figuring out what we can do. And I think the one commonality you'll see in all the neighborhoods in Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Baltimore, where the violence is so pervasive, is that these are communities that are deeply distressed. And in some ways, this seems so self-evident, I even hesitate to say it aloud, but we need to find ways to rebuild and refortify community. And so given how self-evident it is, the question I ask is, where's everyone been? You know, for me, I tell stories, my ambitions are reasonably modest, is I tell stories to introduce readers to communities they otherwise wouldn't venture to introduce them to people they otherwise wouldn't meet. And my hope is that when you put down this book, that you'll look at yourself and the world just a little bit differently.
I think that's a very modest hope there, and something that I don't think anyone could pick up this book and not think differently.
Well, thanks.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alex Kotlowitz is a journalist and the author of An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in March ahead of their conversation at Boswell Book Company. Coming up next, we'll speak with the author of a new Frank Lloyd Wright book that strips its subject down to the studs. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Even if you're not into architecture, you probably know Frank Lloyd Wright's name. But despite being one of the most famous architects of the 20th century, and despite all of the books written about him and his work, the man himself remains a mystery. Even his autobiography was embellished, and historians admit they can never truly verify fact from fiction. One thing that author and journalist Paul Hendrickson thinks has been left out of all previous accounts of Frank Lloyd Wright is his humanity, the man who was haunted by his buildings and their fates as much as he was made famous for them. Hendrickson's new book, Plagued by Fire, is a sympathetic and perceptive look at Wright that he hopes will change the way people perceive him. Hendrickson joined me by phone back in October and begins by explaining why he took a 7-year deep dive into the life of the famous architect.
I feel I came to him organically, a word that Wright would approve of. I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, where there were two famous Wright houses, not only in that small town 50 miles below Chicago, but indeed literally on the same street I lived on. We lived 5 blocks north, where the average people of the town lived, our barely middle-class family. But 5 blocks down at the river, where the wealthy lived, were these two immense Frank Lloyd Wright houses, especially one, the B. Harley Bradley House, 1900, which is in every Frank Lloyd Wright book. It's a seminal house. It's a kind of precursor to all of his prairie work. It's a St. John the Baptist house. And I, as a 9-year-old in 1953, so you can understand something about my age, would sail past that house on my way to the ballpark with my ball glove hooked on my handlebars of my brand new J.C. Higgins 3-speed, which I got for Christmas that year. something was pulling me in and simultaneously scaring me about the B. Harley Bradley. But because I'm a slow learner, it only took 6.5 decades to loop around and find me as a storytelling project. The truth is, Audrey, I'm not even sure I knew the name Frank Lloyd Wright in 1953. As the years went on and I became a kind of amateur student of architecture, I began to learn more about Frank Lloyd Wright. But until I started this project, I was in no way, shape, or form any kind of Frank Lloyd Wright expert. What I am is a narrative nonfiction writer who gets obsessively hooked into these projects.
Why did you choose to set the tone of the book off with the fire and murders at Taliesin right here in Wisconsin? It's an interesting way to set the stage.
I think that's a great follow-up question to what you asked. When you said riddles wrapped up inside of riddles, triangles drawn inside of squares, which is what I say in the text, that event, the most iconic and savage event in Frank Lloyd Wright's life, takes place on August 15th, 1914, when this black servant in a white serving tunic, supposed to be ladling out the midday soup, goes inexplicably berserk and tries to roast the place to cinders, and with a shingling hatchet destroys 7 of the 9 lives in that building. Wright wasn't there that day. That event, for a century and more, has remained in some ways at the heart of the inexplicability of Frank Lloyd Wright's preposterously complicated, tortured life. That event, which, you know, the most casual student of Wright might know something about, can stand for so many other events because it is, Audrey, the riddle wrapped inside the square. So I decided as a journalist to try to find out what I could. And I think I went a distance further than most people have ever gone. For one thing, finding out about the black servant who did this. I mean, history has had a hard time getting his name right. It's Julian Carleton. It's been misspelled. It's been misstated. The first 7 words in the Chicago Tribune the next morning were, "A Barbados Negro with a hand axe yesterday." No, he was from our own country. He was from the Deep South. He was from Alabama in a family of 13 or 15 children whose parents may have been born into slavery. So I, as best I could, went to understand whatever I could about that person. It was as if we always had the deed and none of the life. Did I solve the riddle? No. I only got edges and pieces.
There are indeed a lot of riddles when it comes to Frank Lloyd Wright and his life. You know, what's true, what's not. You admit, along with other historians and other people who have studied and wrote about him, that you never know, even if it's his first primary documents, his own accounts, you don't know what is completely truthful or not. And it's noted that, you know, 72 years as an architect and an egoist, you make sure to point that out. So I'm curious with you and taking a deep dive into this man, do you consider other works about Wright that it's reverencing an egoist? How do you balance that? You know, the weight of the work compared to the weight of the man and his personal character.
Yeah. Maybe in one sense, we could say that the only thing that counts is the work. The only thing that counts is the built work, the architecture that survives. I hear that. But I feel that there is a deeper way to appreciate that architecture through some understanding of the life. But you just hit it on the head again. His life is so difficult to get down. It has been trailed by so many distortions and mistruths, starting with everything that Wright did himself. He was a fantastic prevaricator, a distortionist, a fabulist of his own life. His 1932 autobiography, which I say is one of the great memoirs of the 20th century, even if you must distrust it on every page. I'm an old shoe leather journalist. I worked 30 years in daily journalism, most of it at the Washington Post. I was trying to take nothing at face value. Inadvertently, these mistakes get passed on through each generation, and Wright promulgated so many of them himself in his own lifetime. But the balancing act that you ask about between the egotist and the supreme architect, I tried to approach this with a fundamental respect, even if I needed to challenge every document that I could find at every turn. You know, Audrey, I don't spend 7 years trying to write about someone I don't like. You scrape everything away, all the refuse, all the dross of his ego and his arrogance, his incredible arrogance and his ego. I contend you scrape all that away. You cannot go away from looking at these buildings without appreciating there is a fundamental soulfulness at work. You could say that this book, in some ways, is a search for Frank Lloyd Wright's humanity. And I respectfully suggest that so many previous Wright chroniclers, historians, biographers have wished somehow to neglect that fundamental aspect of his humanity.
One thing that can't be denied is that he affected many people's lives, whether it was through his homes, his work. Of course, as you mentioned, his life was kind of surrounded in scandal at points with his personal life. He left his first wife and children. How do you balance those and take those into account?
It's so difficult to balance. All of his children suffered immeasurably at his hands. He had a total of 7 children, 6 by his first wife. All of them had extremely pain, difficult lives because of the psychic force of the father. He does this seeming unconscionable thing of abandoning his family and his children, the youngest of whom was just a little boy in 1909, just as his lover, Mama, who was his client, she abandoned her 2 children. So you would say, gee, you're making a case for this man's humanity when he does this. You know, you see things in his writings. He says, as if he's hanging himself with his own noose, he says, I've always had the father feeling for my building. I'm not sure I've ever had the father feeling for my children. I mean, how would that make you feel if you were a child of Frank Lloyd Wright and read that? No matter how, even if you had passed in your 7th decade at the time you read that, it doesn't matter. I've never quite had the father feeling for my own children. I do have the father feeling for my buildings. There's a lot you have to forgive in Frank Lloyd Wright. Yes, he built these grand prairie houses. He wanted the fame. He wanted the money. That was the route. That was early on. But there was a part of him, I believe, that always remained a small town boy with rural agrarian values who wanted to build shelter for the common man. Now, isn't that a decent and worthy impulse? That's why the vast bulk of his work is domestic. It's housing. It's not public monuments. It's not train stations. And this sense of wanting not only to build American architecture, but democratic American architecture, I think wanting to do that, you have to pollute it with all of his ego, and that he was building these buildings for himself, in a sense, for his own aesthetic particular purpose he was serving at that moment. Not all of it is mixed together. But I do feel that there's a worthy impulse that has to be looked at when you want to create dignified human shelters for ordinary Americans. What is not to admire there? What is not to defend there in terms of someone's humanity?
One thing you mentioned is that at heart he was a rural Wisconsin boy. And as you know, as people know, Wisconsin was his home. He built here, returned here. Even if he spent some time away doing projects, he always returned here. And you quote that he said, "Wisconsin soil has put the sap into my veins." So
isn't that beautiful? That's so beautiful.
It is. And you growing up not too far away from here, but I'm sure visiting his places here in Wisconsin. How have you found your visits here and seeing his work and connecting with him in that way? Do you look at his buildings and legacy differently now? And should we the next time we see one of his pieces of work?
I'm a native Midwesterner myself, having grown up in Kankakee, Illinois, and then later in the Illinois suburb. Chicago is sort of my hometown. He thought of himself as an old Madison boy. That's what he called himself at one point, an old Madison boy. Nothing made him happier than returning to those rounded bluffs near the Wisconsin River in southwestern Wisconsin, on that hillside of his Welsh forebears, those Lloyd Jones Valleys out in the Wyoming Valley and Helena Valley of Spring Green. No matter how widely worldwide he traveled, nothing made him happier than coming back. And I do feel you can get a sense of what he always preached. That is, that these works of his needed to kind of grow up from the ground itself. They had to come out of the ground searching for the light. And I think a Wisconsinite can take particular pride in that, and a Wisconsinite can get a particular feeling for what he means by that, that these works are indigenous to the land, the soil, the riverbank. It was as if they all grew up together in some long ago ice age. And they sprung right from the ground upon which they were built.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for your time, not just today, but all of the time and dedication you have put into this work about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Thank you very much.
Paul Hendrickson is the author of Plagued by a Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. He spoke with us back in October of 2019, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then speak with one of the co-founders of Atlas Obscura about some of the many Wisconsin entries in the newest print edition. Lake Effect returns right after this, here on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The website Atlas Obscura, which showcases the world's quirkiest wonders, has only been around for a decade. But in that time, the company has visited and cataloged almost 20,000 places. Minnesota native and lifelong explorer, Dylan Thuris is one of the co-founders of Atlas Obscura. The author and filmmaker was at UW-Milwaukee's American Geographical Society Library back in October for a presentation about the second print edition of Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders. He joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North by Skype before his visit here to Milwaukee to discuss the creation of the company.
In some ways, I cite the real inspiration as happening in Wisconsin when I was about 12 years old. Because I grew up in Minnesota, and I went on all these road trips with my parents. And on one of these road trips, you know, we went to Wald Drug and the Corn Palace and all of that kind of stuff. But we also stopped in Spring Green, Wisconsin, the House on the Rock. It always amazes me that most people have never heard of it, although if you're from Wisconsin, it's likely you're familiar, which is this wild, crazy, giant sort of house series of warehouses and rooms filled with everything from the world's largest carousel to a squid fighting a whale sculpture the size of the Statue of Liberty. And as a 12-year-old, I distinctly remember feeling like, if this is what's in the woods in Wisconsin, what else is out there? So from that time, I had always been kind of interested in this kind of unusual travel. It's what I like to do. But it wasn't until I was, you know, older in my early mid-20s that I met my co-founder, Joshua Foer, and we started talking about making a website where you could actually kind of add all these special, incredible places and other people could come and submit their own places. And that was really how the Atlas Obscura was born. It was born as a website in 2009. And we just said, this is the kind of things that we love to find in the world, these, you know, small museums, outsider art projects. And you tell us what amazing hidden wonders you think deserve to be celebrated. So that's what it's been.
And so how do you decide? There are probably as many wonderful hidden wonder things in the world as there are people, you know. So how do you winnow down that list?
I think the actual sort of number of places may be close to infinite. I think you're right. It's really about how you look at a place in a lot of ways. And there is no one set of criteria. It's a little bit, you know it when you see it. You are looking for something that has an element of surprise that makes you feel like the world is a little bigger than you had previously thought, a little stranger. And so we just take it place by place. We see what people submit to us. We read kind of the story, the angle. We look at the photos and you know, do all of our fact-checking and reporting work. And then we decide this place really deserves to be in Atlas Obscura.
Well, you know, the House on the Rock also figured into Neil Gaiman's work, too.
Absolutely. He knows a good a place that is so fantastical, it's hard to believe. I remember in an interview, he said, I actually tamed it down a little bit for the book, because if I wrote it as was true, no one would believe it.
It was American Gods, right?
That's right. Yeah, which I love that book.
Me too. It's a phenomenal book. And, you know, so that's like two people who've mentioned, you know, House on the Rock. And for people who think that that's made up, it really isn't.
Oh,
you
no,
know, it's
it
there. And of course, I'm looking at the map of Wisconsin in the book right now. And of course, just sort of northeast of that is another fabulous Wisconsin thing, which is Dr. Evermore's Forevertron.
Truly, truly. And one of the things that I think is actually so interesting about both the House on the Rock and Dr. Evermore's Forevertron, because Dr. Evermore actually was part of building the House on the Rock, is that there was this kind of, you would call them like an artist collective now, like an installation art collective, basically operating in Wisconsin in the 1960s, 1970s, doing all of this kind of crazy, amazing sculptural work, fabrication work. They just didn't couch themselves as fine artists, so it was never kind of framed that way. But really, that's what was going on. I mean, Dr. Evermore and Sid Boyum and all of the guys who worked on House on the Rock, Alex Jordan, were all kind of like really pioneering. I mean, now there's groups out in like Meow Wolf, which is a giant arts collective that has a not in some ways a sort of similar kind of space out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, is very hip and. But these guys doing this work in Wisconsin were way, way, way ahead. And Dr. Evermore's Forevertron is this amazing sculptural space filled with all kinds of enormous machines and metal bars kind of welded into creatures and spaceships. And
it's supposed to heal you, too.
Yes, that's right. And there's something about time travel involved.
Yes, I think there is. Yeah. Well, in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest seem to be a perfect place for an Atlas Obscura type publication because there's so much. I moved here from the East Coast almost 14 years ago now. And when I got here, just the art installations across the state, it's like there's a lot of really eccentric creative people who made their homes here. And you think, wow, really? It was a long winter, I guess.
I guess there are certain places in the world that seem to be these kind of focal points of just a certain kind of offbeat creativity. It's a kind of creativity that doesn't put on airs. It's not about being, I'm a very fancy artist. It's just like, look, I had a shop and I decided to fill it with little dioramas of anthropomorphic taxidermy where all the animals are playing cards and boxing each other. I'm actually referring to a place called the Moccasin Bar in Hayward, Wisconsin, which is one of my all-time favorite bars. And it's just all of Wisconsin and much of the Midwest is like this. But there's something in the water, something in the air.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about Atlas Obscura, too, is that it's not just human-made things. There's a lot of natural, nature-made things that make up part of this, too. And I just happened to, as I'm sitting here, open the book randomly to, what page am I on? 426. And we're in Mexico. And it's the Hierve el Agua. And it's the freshwater pool topping off what appears to be a frozen waterfall. I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, we try and when we were comprising Atlas, You know, we realized right away, first we wanted to gather things that had been left out of traditional guidebooks. So that was sort of maybe there were some abandoned kind of sites that were like that. There were these kind of outsider artist things or kind of quirky roadside things. But there's also a lot of natural phenomenon that, you know, deserves to be celebrated and is really, truly incredible. And we try and include a lot of those as well. There's one in upper Minnesota that I particularly love called Devil's Kettle. A river flows and then splits into two waterfalls, and one kind of goes on normally, and the other goes into this kettle, into this, you know, rock formation, and just disappears. Basically, no one really is sure what happens after that. They're not sure how it formed because the rock is kind of not the right rock to dissolve in this way, and they're just not sure where it actually ever lets out from the Devil's Kettle. So it's this little fun natural mystery in northern Minnesota.
Yeah, I actually was looking at that page not too long ago, and I was thinking, well, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. The Great Lakes. Yeah.
I mean, it does. But the idea that it's just impossible to trace, or it seems to be, is really fascinating. Do you think that because the world in a lot of ways has gotten smaller, because we're so interconnected now in a way that 19th century explorers weren't and couldn't be, that books and websites like Atlas Obscura play a role in helping us find the wonders of the world when we think we've seen it all?
I think that's right. I think what's ironic is the world does feel small now. We know what's happening in every corner of the globe in some ways, or we think we do. And, you know, all this information is at our fingertips. But in reality, the world is still very, very, very big and filled with more things than we can ever imagine. And so I think part of the point of Atlas Obscura, the sort of almost like the spiritual mission of it, is to remind people that the world is this surprising, wondrous place, that it has not all been done, that not everything is some strip mall or some chain store. Like, sure, you see that everywhere you go in the world now. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find such truly tremendous places and people. And that's our goal, is to give people that feeling, that kind of transcendent sense when you are traveling and you see something, you go, wow, really incredible that this exists and that I'm here and can experience it.
Right. There's something about travel that, if you're open to it and not complaining about how things aren't the same as they are at home, that it opens you up in a way that that almost nothing else does, at least in my experience. If you just arrive somewhere you've never been, and maybe you don't speak the language, and maybe you don't know, you know, which side people are driving on and all of that, but you just sort of open yourself up to it, it changes you in a really fundamental way.
Yeah, I call it seeing with new eyes. And I think there's like, it can be done locally. Like, you can kind of force yourself to approach things with that same sense of openness and curiosity. But travel is just such a shortcut. All the little changes, all the differences, your brain actually snaps sort of on it. Everything that you've been cheating at, where your brain has been ignoring because it sees it and already knows what to expect and what's there. And so you're not actually really taking it in. Your brain has to kind of go, oh, wait, I'm not familiar with any of this. The street signs are different. The stoplights are different. Even the trash cans are different. And so suddenly it's like someone popped a set of new eyeballs in your head. And like, you notice every little thing. And it's a really wonderful experience. And in a way, it's a lesson about how we should try and look at the world as much as possible, traveling or not.
Right. Being aware and open to everyday experience wherever you are. Yeah. And you're right. It's harder when you're in your routine. And,
totally.
Yeah. And so, you know, books and websites like the Atlas Obscura, you know, help you do that. And I have to say, I didn't open this up this far before we started talking today, but I got to the back of the book to Buckminster Fuller's Dymaxion Map. And
oh, yeah.
I think of Buckminster Fuller, and he was this eccentric inventor and I would say a genius.
I love him.
Me too. And yet I had no idea this map existed. And can you explain what it is? Because it's beautiful, but it might not be what you think it is.
He wanted to solve a particular problem, which is that all maps are essentially lies, because you have to take a sphere and mash it down into a flat space. And so, you know, every Mercator map we look at, the map that's in every classroom, it's the Greenland problem, right? Greenland has gotten enormous on this map, and Africa is actually quite a bit sort of smaller relative to the other continents than it should be. And so he thought, okay, what's the closest sort of object to a sphere? And he thought an icosahedron, a 20-sided polyhedron, or basically if you've ever seen a 20-sided dice, it's that shape. And what if I mapped the globe onto this and then just unfolded it and laid that flat? And so that's basically what he did. So in doing so, he also rearranged all the continents because you can unfold it along any given seam. And it's just this incredible way of rethinking the relationship between space, between the continents. And so it's my favorite. It's absolutely my favorite map projection is his Dymaxion map.
Well, then it makes you realize how much we think of the world through the maps that we're familiar with, that's what we think the world is and what it should look like and what is north and what is south and what, you know, which continents are bigger or smaller and what the relationships are. And I'm reminded of a West Wing episode where they turn the Mercator map upside down because why not?
Sure.
It's perfectly valid, and everyone freaks out. It's like, that's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. And because it is, because we're trained to look at it a certain way.
That's right. And when the particular, you can unfold it in any way, but Bucky was really quite fond of one unfolding, which basically every continent is connected to every other continent, which is really right. When you look at it, you don't think about North America being connected to Asia and Russia, but we, of course, are over the Bering Strait. So, you know, when you start to see that there's this almost unending thread that connects the whole world, it really changes the way you think about space and even about how you might travel. You know, you think, oh, maybe what if I did a trip up the West Coast, hopped over the Bering Strait and down the coast of Russia. So that would be a hard trip to do for various
reasons. It might be hard for a lot of reasons, but boy, what a great trip. That would be
exactly
fantastic. End up in Japan, but that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Precisely.
Exactly. So I have to ask you, are there trips that you've taken since you started doing this? Are there trips that you've taken because of the research that you've done?
Oh, every trip I take is because of the research we've done. Every single place we go, I end up visiting an Atlas site. It has completely shaped all of our travel. And it's also given me the chance to take a couple of really grand scale trips that have been amazing. Josh and I took a trip down to South America a number of years back and went to the last Incan bridge, also called the Quechua Chaca, basically this bridge woven out of grass in rural Peru that is rewoven every year because it sort of rots. It's organic material. And it's made in the exact same way that it was during the Incan Empire. It's even though each year the bridge is totally new, it's also this unbroken cultural, historical connection to the Incan Empire. And so it's just seeing places like that. Actually, Josh and I are taking a trip coming up soon. We're helping guide one of our group trips to Turkmenistan to visit a place called the Gates of Hell. And Josh and I have been talking about, you know, we used to sort of joke with each other back when this was like a project being run out of my kitchen, and say, you know, when we make it, we'll have a beer at the edge of the Gates of Hell. Well, a decade later, we are actually going to have a beer at the edge of the Gates of Hell, which is, to clarify what I'm talking about, is a giant 250-foot wide hole in the Turkmenistan desert that has been on fire for 45 years. And so that is a trip that I'm really looking forward to going on. And so absolutely. And you know, even when I'm visiting home in Minneapolis, it's shown me new things. I grew up maybe a couple of miles from this place called Orfield Labs, and I never knew what it was, and it didn't look particularly interesting. But it turns out to have contained the world's quietest room, a room that had the lowest, it had like a negative 20 decibel rating. So you'd go and you'd sit in this little sound chamber, and over time, as your ears attenuated to the space, you would start to like hear the internal workings of your own body because there was literally no other sound to fill that space. So your ears suddenly started picking up on things that you'd never heard before. And at one point I raised my eyebrows and I could hear the sound. And so that was 2 miles from the home that I grew up in. And so that sensation of being reminded that wonders can be incredibly close at hand, that you really don't know what's sort of just in your own backyard, it has been such an ongoing gift of doing this work.
So if there's one piece of advice you could offer a wannabe traveler, what would it be?
I think the piece of advice I would offer is to start where you are, to stop thinking about travel as getting on a plane and flying around the world. That is great and it's wonderful. But if you go at it, you do some research, you sort of set your mind around what is intriguing to you, what stories you want to tell or learn more about, you can travel a 100-mile radius out from your home and find absolutely unbelievable things. So I would tell people to put on their kind of hat of curiosity, their hat of I am an explorer, and look in their own backyard. And I think people are surprised by what they find there.
Well, we are so looking forward to having you here. Dylan Thuris, it has been such a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dylan Thuris is the co-founder and artistic director of AtlasObscura.com. And he spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North in October. The second edition of the Atlas Obscura book is out now. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and won't you join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect? That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.